Hatim has traveled here from the West Coast just to speak with you. Let's give him a hand, please. Thank you, Hatim. Hatim will get to the heart of motivations with which companies are formed and managed. He will share with you his magical wisdom from his experience at Verifone, a company he built and sold to HP for $1.3 billion. What was the secret of his success? He may have seen round the corner and made his own luck, like Howard would say, in this flattening, fast-changing, and interconnected world. So let's start with our opening keynotes from Howard, then Frank on life sciences, and Hatim on IT. Thank you.
Good morning. It's fairly daunting to follow individuals like Howard and Frank, but I'll be speaking from a different point of view. I'm going to be speaking as an operating individual who is truly a graduate of the School of Hard Knocks. I'll focus my discussion on three key points. The first one is, did the virtual company of the 1980s and 1990s foreshadow the flattening of the world at the turn of the century? Second, what have we learned about the motivations of the entrepreneur from the advent of the internet and the ensuing internet bubble, both of which contributed to the flattening of the world? Third, as we strive to innovate in a flat world, how do we apply innovation to the leadership of organizations and the building of corporate cultures? Tom Friedman's best-selling book, The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century, was published in 2005. A recurring question throughout that book is, when did you discover that the world was flat? Friedman's seminal quote on this topic comes from Nilekani, CEO of Infosys, and the quote is as follows. Computers became cheaper and dispersed all over the world, and there was an explosion of software, proprietary software that can chop up any piece of work and send one part to Boston, one part to Bangalore, and one part to Beijing, making it easy to do remote development. When all of these things suddenly came together in the year 2000, they created a platform where intellectual work and intellectual capital could be delivered from anywhere. Against that backdrop, allow me to juxtapose an everyday situation from a company called Verifone. This situation occurred in 1991. The European Development Center in Paris was developing a new product that required a graphic display to support multiple languages, including Arabic, Chinese, and Russian. In 1991, using the company-wide email system and the resources of R&D centers in Europe, Asia, and the United States, the engineers in Paris were able to source 20 proposals from 14 vendors in 7 countries in 21 days. Clearly, Verifone was innovating in a world that was perceived to be round. However, therefore, when did the world become flat? For Nandan Nilekani, the CEO of Infosys, the world became flat in 2000, and he transformed his company. For Thomas Friedman, the world became flat in 2003, and he started writing a best-selling book about it. For Verifone, widely recognized as the world's first virtual company, the world became flat in 1986. The moral of the story is as follows. You can build any kind of company you want to build, how and when you want to build it. The only barriers are your imagination and your determination. The essence of entrepreneurship is to create and lead, rather than follow the established norm, the latest trend, or the latest best-selling book. Creation and leadership require the courage to challenge the conventional wisdom and to take risks. To quote George Bernard Shaw on this point, some men see things as they are and ask why. Others dream of things that never were and ask why not. Now, turning to our first point, that the virtual company of the 1980s and 1990s foreshadow the flattening of the world at the turn of the century. Let's apply the Friedman test to Verifone. Those of you who have read the book will recall the 10 forces that flatten the world, which provide a useful point of comparison. Flattener number one was called when the walls came down and the windows went up. To quote Friedman on this point, the fall of Berlin on November 11, 1989, tipped the balance of power across the world towards those advocating democratic, free market-oriented governance and away from those advocating authoritarian rule. He follows in the book with the emphasis talking about, and what you are seeing in Bangalore today meaning the early 2000s, is really the culmination of all that coming together. The playing field is being leveled. The point of fact, Verifone launched operations in India in 1989, at least a decade before it became fashionable. State ownership of the entire economic infrastructure in India had been in effect since 1947 and nearly bankrupted the country by 1991. In 1989, 2 full years before India opened its economy to private enterprise and foreign investment, Verifone established a large R&D center in Bangalore. Today, in 2006, Bangalore is full of these centers for US and European technology companies. But in 1989, Verifone pioneered the trend. Quoting Friedman again, even as the walls fell, there were still a lot of barriers to seamless global integration. Remember when Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992, virtually no one outside of government and academia had email. And when I, Friedman, was writing The Lexus and the Olive Tree in 1998, the internet and e-commerce were just taking off. Point of fact, Verifone invented its own information technology infrastructure to enable the company to operate virtually across traditional barriers of time and distance. A decade before the advent of the commercial internet, Verifone developed its own wide area network powered by used DEC VAX mini computers. We were too cheap to buy them new, which became a functional precursor to today's corporate intranet. I share with you an excerpt from an article that appeared in Business Week in the year 1994.
Verifone's long-distance operating style would be impossible without its computer system, which makes every bit of corporate information available online, and a management culture that embraces computers for almost every task. Everyone from the chairman to the most junior clerk is issued a laptop computer and is expected to learn how to use it. Internally, paper memos are banned. It is interesting to note that the ethos of leadership at this virtual company consisted of 5% technology, but 95% psychology. Now let's look at Friedman's flattener number 3, which was called workflow software. To quote Friedman, it is now possible for more and more people to collaborate and compete on a more equal footing using computers, email, and networks. Against that, an article in Forbes in the year 1993, virtually all of its work processes are carved up and electronically distributed to speed things up, while most multinational companies consider time zone differences a hassle, Verifone uses the network to turn them into an advantage. When a group at one facility working on a time-critical project is ready to go home, it hands off everything it has, from engineering specs to customer data, to a group that is perhaps 8 hours earlier in its day. By passing work from, say, San Francisco to Taipei to London and back to San Francisco, the company can keep a project going 24 hours a day without requiring anyone to work overtime. I could give you many more examples, but as these few attest, the virtual company presaged what Friedman refers to as the triple convergence. As the world's first virtual company, Verifone was a product of innovative leadership. Whether in 1986 or 2006, building a virtual company, a company built to last, means creating a new and unique entity. The process requires the ability to challenge the human mind. You need to have the courage to dream, as well as the courage to turn your dream into reality. Now, turning to our second point about the motivations of the entrepreneur from the advent of the internet and the ensuing internet bubble, building a company to last versus building a company to flip is a fundamental choice that has faced entrepreneurs since the dawn of time. The concept of building a company to last invokes a continuum of enduring management values and practices. The key 6 practices are creating and sustaining a corporate culture of excellence. Number 2 is moving the point of power to the individual employee. Number 3 is thinking globally while acting locally. Number 4 is instilling focus and accountability at all levels of the organization. Number 5 is questioning paradigms and resisting complacency. And number 6 is institutionalizing leadership by example. These 6 principles reflect the great enterprises of the 20th century: a General Electric, a Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Merck Sharp & Dohme, to name a few. and they reflect the core value of the entrepreneurs who built them. However, the internet bubble engendered a new generation of entrepreneurs with a built-to-flip mentality. To quote an article from Fast Company in the year 2000, "No need to build a company, much less one with enduring value. Today, it's enough to pull together a good story, to implement the rough draft of an idea, and presto, instant wealth. No need to bother with the time-honored method of self-made millionaires to create substantial value by working diligently over an extended period." In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the entire motivation to start a company came down to ramping it up as quickly as possible, then taking it public and or selling it out in an acquisition, all within 12 to 18 months. The internet bubble caused the entrepreneurial mindset to degenerate from one of risk, contribution, and reward to one of wealth entitlement, thereby creating an entitlement culture in which the mediocre flourished. By fostering this culture, the built-to-flip mentality not only debases the concept of meaningful work, but ultimately debases those who feel entitled. This concept is closely related to the trap of personal comparisons. And Howard Stevenson talked about the trap when he talked about an individual who was worth $60 million, but who was very unhappy because he wasn't quite as wealthy as somebody else. I submit to you that comparison is the cardinal sin of modern life. It traps us in a game that we cannot win. Once we define ourselves in terms of others, we lose the freedom to shape our own lives. The entrepreneurs behind the great enterprises represent the antithesis of this kind of behavior. They work hard to create a superb management team and cultivate a culture that can withstand adversity and change. They are dedicated to building companies with a sense of purpose around core values that infuse work with the kind of money and goes beyond just making money. They adhere to principles that they knew in their gut were true, and they followed their inner sense in terms of what they felt was truly right. To be a true entrepreneur, I believe there are three elements that really must be in the entrepreneur's heart. The first one, we must be committed to doing our work with unadulterated excellence, no matter how arduous the task or how long the road. Number two, our work must make a contribution that we can be proud of. Number three, our work must provide us with a sense of purpose and meaning that goes beyond just making money. Now, turning to my last point, as we strive to innovate in a flat world, how do we apply innovation to the leadership of organizations and the building of corporate cultures? Leadership is an intensely personal and successful leaders, and I think Howard referred to that, are students of human nature. A true leader understands the frailties of human nature and addresses them, fully understanding the paradox of leadership and its impact on people. In his novel, Canary Row, John Steinbeck makes a provocative statement on this point, and I quote Steinbeck, "The things most admired in men, kindness and generosity, openness, honesty, understanding, and feeling are the equivalents of failure in our system. And those traits we detest, sharpness, greed, acquisitiveness, meanness, egotism, and self-interest, are the traits of success. And while men admire the quality of the first, they love the product of the second." In the final analysis, the most effective leadership is a function of moral authority rather than absolute authority. Many employees, interestingly enough, expect and respond to absolute authority. However, it is moral authority that builds a company's character and propagates values across the organization through leadership by example. About 15 years ago, in 1991, I captured my own deeply held convictions about leadership, and I still refer to them often. The first one is lead by example. The second one, take the toughest problems on yourself. You can't delegate the difficult decisions to your staff. As a leader, you must assume personal responsibility for making the call and accepting the consequences. Number three, set standards of excellence and measure performance against them. Number four, give commitment, get commitment. Number five, maintain a driving sense of urgency. Number six, pay attention to detail. Number seven, accept failure. Nobody likes to fail. But a leader can't afford to be paralyzed by the fear of being wrong. Number eight, recognize limits. Number nine, set priorities. And number 10, be tough, but be fair. This point sums it up. Leadership is an intensely personal and interpersonal skill. How you relate to your staff means everything. Toughness starts with your own standards, your own performance, and the example you set. Fairness is the other side of the coin. Judge others as you would judge yourself, fairly and consistently. So in a very real sense, corporate culture is the human outcome of leadership. In 1995, the Harvard Business School published the first of two case studies on Verifone, and I'd like to quote a relevant excerpt. One of the first things Verifone management undertook in 1986 was the creation of a corporate philosophy manual. This document became the basis for all internal and external company activities. This philosophy is a pocket-sized brochure. It documented eight simple precepts by which employees were expected to live and work. Each page was devoted to the development of one precept. All pages were translated into 8 languages in 1986 to make them readily accessible to employees, customers, suppliers, partners, and investors throughout the company's global universe. The philosophy formed the cornerstone of an employee communications and education initiative called Commitment to Excellence. Again, to quote the 1995 HBS case study, management developed an environment conducive to company growth outside the context of a cult of personality. A subtle approach of educating the entire organization through a constant stream of communiques was used. In addition to the Verifone philosophy, which stated the underlying precepts by which all Verifoners were expected to live and work, a series of excellence in thought notes and a collection of excellence in action vignettes completed the educational tool set. One of these vignettes, in which I happen to be personally involved, demonstrated the company's absolute and unconditional commitment to customers. In the early 1990s, the company had entered the market in France and was fighting to gain traction with prospects. We were scheduled to meet the senior management of one of the top 3 banks in Paris. It was raining and Paris traffic was totally gridlocked. The taxi never showed up, and the local sales and marketing manager and I were faced with the choice of being terribly late or of cancelling the meeting. We donned raincoats and helmets and jumped on his motorcycle. The sales manager weaved through the gridlock and even took to the sidewalk when necessary, using his motorcycle horn to clear a path. We made it to the meeting in 20 minutes, which not only impressed the bankers, but established the company's reputation in the Paris banking community. The ultimate value of corporate culture can be summed up very succinctly. If you believe you can change the perceptions of those around you, if you believe you can change the business methods of your customers, if you believe you can change the behavior of your competitors, in fact, if you believe you can change the structure of your industry. In conclusion, the world was flat 20 years ago. It'll be even flatter 20 years from now. The example of Verifone and its emergence as a virtual company in 1986 leads us to imagine how the flat world will evolve from here towards 2026 and beyond. As entrepreneurs, we can envision the possibilities and project the opportunities for a new generation of enterprises, the 21st century successor to the virtual company. One is reminded of Don Quixote, the classic novel by Cervantes. We all have, without exception, the human ability to use imagination to suppress reality, block preconceived ideas and fear, and let creative thinking and the entrepreneurial spirit lead man to new horizons not reachable through pure rational thinking. Our challenge, ladies and gentlemen, is not to build good companies. It is to build great companies built on enduring values. Cervantes encouraged us to dream so that we do not become prisoners of our own minds. Martin Luther King Jr., in his speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in August 1963, took this one step further. Dr. King said, "I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be laid low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." The courage to dream means a commitment to excellence, unadulterated excellence. It means a measurable contribution. It means purpose and meaning beyond money. And last but not least, it means leadership by example. Do as I do, not do as I say. Thank you for your time.